My name is Walt Woodin, and this is the fourth session under Humankind and Food. Today will be Alternative Agriculture. What we've done in the other three is to talk about agriculture and what preceded agriculture in sort of a time sequence. So today we want to talk about alternative agriculture. And I think the first thing we should do is describe what this name implies. And it basically comes out of thinking that has arisen, I'd say, in the last 10, 15, 20 years. And it represents a coming together of two extremes that evolved in the agricultural industry. On one end of this extreme was what is referred to as, it might even be called, some places called traditional, but that's not a good, that's not a real good term either, so let's put a little question mark over that. Some people say intensive agriculture. Some people say chemical agriculture. Okay, and so in other words, it's the agriculture that has arisen as scientists found out more and more about plant nutrients and so on, and chemistry. So it's in other words, it's a modern agriculture, rapid growing type of an agriculture that we have. Okay, on the other extreme, we've had, and I don't know what this would have been called originally, but over here maybe it was organic gardening. My penmanship today is horrible. But organic, this was a term that on this end of the spectrum, people said that any of these chemicals, like you take, if you took calcium or any of those chemicals, if they came from this end of the spectrum, if they were inorganic chemicals, they were not as good as an organic chemical. Okay? So this was on this end of the spectrum. And what was happening is that you had organic people that would be at odds, so to speak, with the professor at the university. Somebody said, and kind of throwing arrows at each other and saying, well, you're wrong, and you're wrong, and back and forth. Okay? So you had a spectrum going here of the traditional or agriculture that evolved versus over here. And I personally had the experience that at Iowa State University, where we brought in an individual into the agronomy department to talk about getting more to alternative agriculture, sustainable agriculture, just to discuss this. And some of the older professors over here, really, they said, well, I don't even want to go hear this, because I don't even want to hear what this young man is talking about, because we don't believe that, you know. We've got experiments to show that this is what happens when you put on so much of this and so much of that. And so this is, okay. Well, what you've got happening now is a whole terms that relate to alternative agriculture, and it's someplace in the middle. It's like a lot of things in life, that this isn't plus and this isn't minus, or this isn't right and this is wrong. There's a lot of gray area in between. And so I think we're in a good stage right now where we're the university people and the people that believe on this side and here, we can get together and we can talk about these things and we can do research that aims at getting answers. So that's alternative agriculture's in the middle. There's another term that it's not quite synonymous with it, but it's used. It's called sustainable agriculture. In other words, if you start thinking about how we're going to produce all this food into the future, we want an agricultural system that is sustainable. Now, if we think as humans that if this is my feeling, if you think you can get a bunch of agronomists together like I am, and we can map out a way to grow all the food into the future that's going to be absolutely sustainable, I myself I'm patting myself, my ego, a little bit too much, because I don't think we can quite do that. In other words, we don't have all the answers to how we're going to keep all this agriculture going. We have some of the ideas, we can go that direction, but we certainly can't say we're going to make this agriculture sustainable forever. No way, because we don't know what's coming down the pipe. We don't know how the climate's going to change. There are a lot of things we don't know. So they don't like the term as well, a sustainable agriculture. There was another one that came out, and it's rather interesting. It came out, it was called low input sustainable ag. And you take the acronym for that was LISA. Low input sustainable agriculture. Well, a lot of people didn't like that terminology because they say, okay, we aren't going to put as much fertilizer on, so we're going to put a lower input of fertilizer on, and that's low input. And the person that's doing it said, yeah, but you're putting me down because I'm still using my head and I'm putting as much high input of intelligence into this as I did before. In fact, I'm putting a higher input of intelligence into this operation whereby I use lower inputs of herbicides, pesticides, chemicals, etc. So anyhow, it wasn't low input of intelligence, it was low input. So they didn't like that term. So all this is kind of gone by the boards. And they've gone back to what they call SARI. And this is sustainable, the terminology, sustainable agricultural research. What is that again? Let me make sure I've got it. It's part of the United States Department of Agriculture. Don't even remember it myself. Sustainable Ag Research and Education. I think that's it. Okay, so that's enough maybe about these terms. You can see how it's arriving. We're in the middle now, and this is where things are beginning to move ahead. And that's what I'd like to talk about today. Are there any questions about that? There's a whole bunch of other terms. Biointensive gardening, and you know, they're just a long list of terms that have come up. But in my view, this is sort of what we're in the middle. We're in a stage where we can communicate, we can begin to move ahead. Now, how did it get that way? I guess that would be the first question to ask. I'm talking before this week how this agriculture has evolved. How did it get that way, and where are we at right now? And what are we going to do about it? So if you flip, maybe I can do it. Do you want to push that ahead on? Maybe I'll do it. Just push that ahead on the slides.
Right.
We don't need to turn off the lights. We can just look at these slides and keep talking. If you have any questions at any time, let me know. Okay, this is one I've used before this week, and it's still an approach I like to think about. In other words, food for humankind, land and water, air, vegetation, and we go through animals and we finally get back to humankind again. That's the flow system. That's what we like to keep in mind. And I showed this picture last evening. This is poor land. This is land that was somebody thought they could farm up in northern Minnesota. There were fences built here. Now it's maybe just pasture, and I'll be going back into timber. That's not good land. This is land in Iowa. This is good land, but man, it's been misused because it's the wind erosion has taken it off the field and put it into the ditch. And that's not good farming or good agriculture. So, this is a good time to bring up, I'll put some of these up on the board, things that are being tossed around. BMP is just a bundle of practices that are called best management practices. Best management practices. This is a terminology that is used. And so when agronomists get together, when you teach a class in an agricultural college to students, we talk about best management practices. Well, this is obviously not a best management practice over here to keep this land open in the wintertime. And there are many ways that can be handled. Okay, so there were mistakes made in agriculture. And there have been some corrections, and I put this one in to show. This is a correction that shows research that was done. I just showed you how the wind erosion can cause problems. So these are sets of plots down in the experiment station in southern Iowa where I worked, and they're called runoff plots. In other words, they know the extent. This is an 8% slope going downhill. These are long protected strips. So you can plant them in different crops during the growing season. This one could be planted corn. This one could be put in alfalfa, different grasses. And at the bottom of the thing, you have all of the water that would run off of this plot, plus the soil that it picked up, is collected at the bottom in a big tank. And that can be measured and weighed. And so you have a certain intensity of rainfall. You know how much rainfall there was, you can check it out. So there were a series of these runoff plots set up all over the United States in various experiment stations. And we were doing some work with this one some years ago with different types of grasses. So there have been corrections made to find out how we can move ahead. But anyhow, some farms went out of business and went broke. I mean, this is agriculture. This is a farm. You see a productive farm in the background and one in the foreground, didn't make it. But even in spite of going out, there's a pressure. Here's a pressure more recent years. Here's some land in southern Iowa where they're cleaning out the trees. They're going to be seeding this down. They're trying to open up some more area to grow crops. So there's always a pressure to be developing and moving on, even though. And here, as I pointed out, I believe last night I had this picture in to show that in this rolling hilly land in western Iowa where there's pressure, they had made a bench terrace, what we call a bench terrace. And so you can go in there with about 17, 15, 16 rows of corn. You could go in and plant, put up your field, you could plant it, use an 8-row corn planter and kind of plant 8 rows going this way and 8 rows going the other way, and you got your corn field planted. But you had to distort the land quite a bit to get this done. So that's an approach. This was just being done experimentally. And this is a shot I took of some young boys in western Iowa. And there's the pressure to grow the corn crops, to grow crops on those hills. But in spite of that, you get out in central Iowa and you look at a snowbank in the middle of the winter, and you got this silt that the wind is blowing the silt off the fields and put it into snowbanks. So when this melts down, you've got a bunch of silt there. So those things happen, unless there is an effort. Now, let's take one. This is some slides that I just saw these presented recently, and I asked this young man if I could take these along to Holden Village, because I think this will show you what's happened to one particular type of business with modern agriculture. And this is a dairy enterprise. And because we all know it's gotten bigger. But he put together some slides, and I asked him if he could bring them. This is what's happened. The total, if we take the year 1900 all the way up to the year 2000, or 1980, 1990, and this is milk production, total U.S. milk production in billions of pounds. Look at it. It's gone up like that. So in other words, there's enough milk being produced to take care of apparently to take care of all the people who want to buy milk in this country. So it's going on. But you look at this one. Well, how about the size of the U.S. dairy cow herd? He's talking about all the cows, dairy cows, put together in this country. How many are there? Look what happened. In the early years, it kept going up the number. Then as the productivity per cow got higher, it started dropping off. And it's still dropping off. In other words, it doesn't take as many cows. It only takes about 9 million dairy cows in this country to produce all that milk that we're getting more and more milk. So each cow is producing more milk. Now, I got that in backwards, and I'm sorry. But basically, if you can just think of this, this is slide 1960, 1980, and it just shows production per cow was going up, milk cow number was going down, and milk production total was keeping, and I was showing that was even going up. So it sort of shows the same thing as the other one. Now then, this is put in production per cow from the year 1900. How much milk does each cow produce per year? Okay, look at where it was back here in 1900. When I was a kid back in northern Wisconsin, you know, if you would have cows that produced 4,000 to 5,000 pounds of milk a year, and ours didn't produce that much, I know that, because we were on a small farm. That was great, but look at where it is now. Look at where it's going. It just keeps going up. 18,000 pounds of milk per year. And I know that one of the benchmarks that people say, you know, they're shooting for 25,000 pounds of milk per cow per year. And these people that keep promoting that's the way it's going. I said, why? You know, why is that? Why? Why does it just keep going up? It's just like a milk factory. That's not a farm anymore. It's almost like a milk factory, not a farm. And that's exactly what it is. It's sort of a milk factory. This is a picture in the milking parlor. And you know, when maybe they could be milking 300-400 cows, maybe milk cows continuously all day long. If they milk the cows three times a day, which some do, traditionally it was twice, but if they milk cows three times a day, they've got crews that just work continuously milking the cows. And this is milking powder. They come in, they know where to go, they bring them in, and the milker, he's got all his controls right here, and he knows how to switch these, put on the teacups onto the cow, and extract the milk, not extract it, but take it, and it goes in the pipeline, and next cow, you know, I mean, just like that. So that's, yes?
I was wondering, does that amount of milking, is that injurious to the cow? Do they have to do anything special in terms of harmonial or feeding the cow to make it milk that much? Is that
oh, yes, cow? Yes, all of those, all of the above. Okay. It's not injurious to the cow necessarily, except that the breeding of the cow, in other words, the breed, this happened to be Holstein cows, the breeding of the cow is such that the genetics of the cow is, maybe it's been bred so it can withstand this. And there are some mastitis is a disease, or not a disease, but it's an inflammation of the cow's udder that occurs if the milking utensils aren't clean, etc., etc., etc. And if the cow gets mastitis and it's serious, they can be out of that. In other words, they're out of there.
They sell to experimental people that do
the
experiments.
Pardon?
They sell people that do experiments.
No. Actually, I guess a broken down milk cow maybe goes to slaughter. Okay, and so it's a highly intensive agricultural system that moves, and that you implied, Dan, in your question about that the types of feeding, the absolutely. I mean, it has to be very precise type of feeding, a standard feeding. And I brought those in just to show that this is a highly intensive agricultural industry. And and it's happening in New Zealand, it's happening in Japan and in Hokkaido, it's happening in other places of the world. In other words, milk production has followed this intensification direction. And what's happened is that people are saying, say, rather than those cows producing 25,000 pounds of milk, you think it's possible that we could be in the dairy business and have cows and graze and they only produce 15,000 pounds of milk per year? That's the type of question that's being asked. And in reports that have been put out now, there's examples of cases where this actually, it is a possibility. Yes?
What's the average lifespan of a cow like that?
I don't know for sure. If they get 5, 6, 7 years out of the cows, I think they're very happy.
Where it used to be 8 to 10.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But I can't. Sven, do you know? No. Maybe somebody else would know, but it's kind of scary when, yes?
It's kind of scary what?
Kind of scary to think that the lifespan is not that long.
Have you ever seen those ads in magazines that show what happens to some of those cows that are used for that, and they can't, they get diseases or something goes wrong, and they get sick, whatever that's called.
Mastitis or something else, yeah.
And they lose body parts and their skin. Well,
oh, when they go to the slaughterhouse, right.
No, yeah. When they get sick and they don't die necessarily. I mean, it's not all this nice, clean every cow goes in and there's no dirt on the cow and everything's sterile, and then all the cows come out and like a little plastic production line. You know, I mean, there's a reality behind that nice, clean, fix that picture that's not as pretty and nice and clean.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there is a, this is sort of reminded, they had, I'm sort of reminded of, you might say, the question is, what do you do with old dairy cows? Well, they go to slaughter. So, and they say, what, in the cities, in Minneapolis, St. Paul, what do you do with old greyhounds that are used at the racetracks? Well, they hope that somebody will take them on as pets. You walk the lakes in Minneapolis, and here's, you can get yourself a greyhound dog that used to run at the tracks that they don't bet on anymore. You could get that greyhound dog for a pet, or to make sure that it has a home. Now, that's not true in the dairy cow business, but it's, in other words, it's not just in agriculture that animals are become older and non-usable, so to speak. Okay, now the dairy, and I want to move on here and show you that, okay, so what, now we want the next one. So what, that's just one industry. In other words, agriculture has changed, is changing, and we could have done the same thing with corn production or maybe even rice production to show that this type of agriculture that I have shown on the right-hand side was moving fast. It was a lot of questions raised about, you know, what are, is this the agriculture we want? Is this a mistake? And as I said earlier in the week, that they said maybe was this one of the biggest mistakes that has been foisted off on mankind or humankind, that agriculture was developed. You know, people are actually saying that. They say, is this what we have to do to go through to get food to feed our populations? See, there's some ethical questions. Okay, now, I say there's hope, and there's a lot going on. Here is a shot taken, and I put this one in. This is a picture showing that rather than having a complete cornfield, you know, just acres and acres of cornfield where you're subject to erosion, this is some experimental work being done by a former colleague of mine that they're doing. They're planting this is called alternate strip cropping, and it actually has orientation to the directions, and so that you get a better utilization of sunlight. So that would be one thing could be done in crops. Here's something could be done in the hillsides, in the rougher land. As I pointed out before, this land in the 1930s was terraced, put terraces in here so you could grow corn around these terraces. And now it's gone back into a close growing crop, a legume, a grass, on these hills. And then of course those can be grazed by livestock. Those can be grazed by livestock. These happen to be beef animals. And so that has a utilization. In other words, it's not competing. This is not competing with crops that are grown directly for food production. Or with sheep. It's interesting, some of the reading, I never realized this had happened. I didn't realize this had happened because I was so busy teaching and doing research that people were saying for a while, we've got to get rid of sheep. We got rid of sheep because we can make rayon fibers and nylon, da 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 da. We can do it much more efficiently than having wool around. That actually was, somebody was proposing that. And it seems, when you stop and think about it, it doesn't make much sense, because are these the sheep that give us a crop of wool each year? Is that the direction we want to go, that we're going to eliminate them? Yes, Dan, you had a question.
Yeah, I don't know if it's kind of off the point here, but you mentioned about efficiency. There's a book out, the guy is, he was the heir to the Baskin and Robbins.
Yes.
Fortune.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with it?
Right, it's Diet for a...
For a New Planet.
A New Planet, right. Yeah. By...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the things that he postulates is that basically what he's, I think what he's saying is that by feeding the beef to, that we feed them and then slaughter them for meat, that if we didn't use so much the grains to feed them, it would be a lot more productive in terms of feeding the masses directly, because between the amount of food that goes into fatten the beef, the cattle, that we actually are being inefficient with our use of foods. And I don't just want to hear what you have to say.
Well, yes, the book is in the library, and it's in the room in here. I haven't read it, but I browsed through it, and he's raising some questions that others are raised that are on one extreme, mm-hmm. right? And in my mind, it would be like saying, back 15 years ago, we would have said, General Motors refuses to make small cars for us, so let's dump them. You know, let's just, if they can't make small cars and get it done for us right away, you know, let's just some really rapid, quick surgery on that. And it doesn't, I guess what I'm saying is that it's a good thing that he writes, the books are written like that, because it alerts everybody to get, let's change it, let's be doing some changing. Mm-hmm. And I haven't, like I say, I haven't read the book, but in some of those books that have been really extreme on one side or the other, if the scientist writes it and gets too far off into the blue sky, you know, you might say, well, that's not possible. If somebody writes it on the other side and they get off, they say, well, that's not realistic either. So someplace in the middle.
Yeah.
And so there have been people that, I don't know if he did it or not, but you can calculate out. In fact, I did one time, one of our professors at Iowa State in his class, and I presented in my class because I said that Brent Pierce has said that you could take the state of Iowa with 35 million acres in the state of Iowa, and if we planted soybeans in Iowa, border to border, you know, 35 million acres of soybeans, we'd have enough protein. I think at that time he calculated there was enough protein there to feed the world.
Yes, that's...
You know, see what I mean?
Yeah.
So you can really get this, you can get kind of carried away with the extremes of these things. I think Robbins has a zeal and a desire to get some things changed.
Yeah, it comes from two references, from the inefficiency of feeding cattle,
yeah.
feeding humans, and it also comes from the position of what's the word, inhumanity or the cruelty
yeah.
To these animals that we are.
Is he a vegetarian himself?
He's a vegetarian, and I think based on those two propositions of mm-hmm. the inefficiency and the cruelty of the animals.
Yeah. Well, these are questions that are raised,
yeah.
and I know that this could be and I'd urge people to read those books. They've got a tremendous number of books back.
I have a question now. With all the propaganda against meat, and how come beef is so high?
Well,
I think they got up to a dollar one.
Yeah, did you hear the question that been back that with all the propaganda against meat, how come the price is so high? Well, I guess I'd say, well, how come a loaf of bread costs as much as it does?
Yeah.
And I don't have the figures for you, but if the farmer is getting what for a bushel of wheat $4 to $5, and it changes 10 cents or whatever. They right away say, oh, you know, that's going to change it. And the truth of the matter is that what they pay the farmer has maybe not too much to do with what gets charged in the supermarket.
But usually it works in reverse like that. I mean,
yeah.
the farmer's been getting this dollar,
yeah.
dollar, so, 1 cent for feeders coming in.
So beef is high, no question about it. And, but just like we could say, because of what I showed you about the dairy industry, because you saw the milking machine set up. There's a tremendous investment there. And they're working, the bigger they get, the finer the margin they're working on, so to speak. And so that the price has to be high. And in fact, I have brother-in-laws, the Carroll's brothers, that farm dairy industry in Wisconsin. And when you keep, maybe it's gone up because the demand's been less. There could be a possibility. In other words, they're those that sell it. See, there also are organic beefs coming on the market, too.
Yeah.
Right. Yes?
Compare a box of cornflakes per pound to what you pay for a pound of beef. Your cornflakes is a lot higher priced than what your box of cornflakes is.
That's right.
Yeah, that is true. It's a good point.
The farmer isn't getting the price for
yeah.
the farm.
Yeah.
That's by alternative.
Yeah.
The farmer isn't getting that, as Kellogg's getting that, or
Well, there's a tremendous, there's a lot of advertising, you know, and all that. I've heard presentation on that, and it you can't put all the blame at the farmer level for this.
It's all those middle people. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it is the middle people, but in this particular thing, it's bothered me. Or I wondered about it all winter long. It's just up, when they, I don't know. Maybe the use of it isn't going up. Maybe they're all making mistakes.
You buy things if you buy fresh food as though it were packaged, then processed and put on the shelf with a shelf life of several months, then you're going to be paying high prices for those things. But if you go and buy whatever is low at the time that particular fresh item is being sold at a low price, then you're not going to be paying high prices for beef or anything else. If you go in there and buy beef every day for 6 years, you're going to be paying all different kinds of prices, including high prices and low prices.
Okay, just one slide here that I put in because I showed that we're looking to changes. And here would be, here's why it'd be interesting to get in a discussion with Robbins, you know, the author of the book, because you see, I don't know how much he says about this, but when we're talking about animals, meat and milk, there are a lot of other products that benefit us that don't come out. In other words, he can be a vegetarian, but these animals still provide fiber, skins, inedible products. They provide traction. I have another slide I'm bringing in, but in developing countries, livestock still provide a lot of power and so forth. And waste. So all of these things that are coming in, and so it's a little difficult for me to when I read some of the books, if they say let's get rid of some of the animals. Now, Jerry Rifkin in Washington, D.C., he's got another one, I think it's called book. He just really gets right at the beef industry. He doesn't get on the dairy industry. He gets at beef, you know, because there, he said, their grains are being used where man could use those. Those grains are being fed. And that's the argument. Well, it's going to shake out someplace after a while. And I think these people are really extreme on one end or the other. And of course you can imagine the farmer is really pretty extreme because he's going to be want to make a living off of what he's been doing. Okay, so again, hope coming in with agricultural research to grow new grasses. Here, I just put this one here. It's the growing of a legume and a grass together and finding out all of the complications of what's happening, what is the competition that goes on. And then putting these into plots where you test out. Here you see the grass growing with, or legume growing with the grass. Testing these out, getting the yields, getting the information, teaching it in classes. This is what I always use in class. This is what we'd like to see happen if we grow a broadleaf legume with a grass. That when it's defoliated, if you cut it off and take it away for hay or if an animal grazes it, that it'll grow back in the same way it was there before. If you come in, but that's not the way plants grow necessarily because of sunlight. This plant may want more sunlight, and so when you defoliate this plant, lo and behold, it doesn't grow up as much when it comes back. Now, if you add an animal into this gets really complicated, see? And there are a lot of areas of the world where grazing is their sustenance, to graze cattle. The animal, if the animal selects this plant, comes in and says, I don't like this grass, I like this. And then when it goes back, this plant is weakened and eventually it's driven out of the mixture and you end up with just grass. So those are things that talk about grazing management. That is occurring. When you have overgrazing in some of these areas of the world, you end up with desertification and all those things. These are dynamic things that are going on that need to be understood and talked about and so that we can eliminate. Or to represent growth. How much could you graze on a legume grass mixture? When can you graze it? From April to December, the months. Here is about the amount of growth you get. This is the growth curve of what you've grown, and so to graze this, you maybe can put about so many cows per acre on that. You can put more cows per acre at that time of the year, and you can put less there. Make it fit the growth curve of the plants. So these things are all possibilities as we move ahead and learn. This one is in a little bit backwards, I'm sorry. But now what I want to talk about, a very amazing plant that offers some hope for in agriculture and elsewhere. This is alfalfa. I put it backwards, I'm sorry, in crop rotations. Alfalfa, or lucerne, was grown by the Romans. And the Romans, basically the English and Western Europe learned from what the Romans had done that you would rotate this plant that fixes nitrogen and adds nitrogen to the soil, would be rotated with other crops. In other words, if you grow a year of alfalfa or lucerne, that would furnish enough nitrogen so that you can put corn in the following year and the corn crop will grow. And then you come back. And by rotating crops, you keep down the amount of disease, you keep down some of the insect populations, you do a natural way of providing nitrogen and so forth. Now what happened in modern agriculture was that they tended to say, well, we're just going to grow corn. So you kind of eliminated the crop rotations. Well, now under alternative agriculture, this crop rotation business is coming back in. And it's coming in a new way. Now they have found that some of these alfalfas that will only grow for 1 or 2 years fix more nitrogen. They fix more nitrogen, so they maybe fit better into the scheme of things. Yes?
Do you harvest the alfalfa or plow it under?
Yeah, it's plowed under. It's plowed under various combinations. You might take one crop and then plow the rest under. Sweet clover used to be a plant that was just what they call a green manure crop. It was a green manure. It was plowed under to give. And that kind of went out with this hurried up agriculture. Well, you see, it's coming back now, alternative agriculture. All these ideas are coming back under alternative agriculture.
Do you know how much soil you build if you plow it in?
Yep. It'll furnish adequately enough for 1 year of corn. And for 1 year of corn production, you need about 130 pounds of N nitrogen put on per acre. And that nitrogen, well, where does that come from? Nitrogen that the corn, a lot of the corn people are using, is coming from natural gas, which is to synthesize nitrogen in a plant, which is sold, which is put on the corn field to grow the corn crop, to get the grain, like I said yesterday, to get the grain off, to take the grain, though, not the plant, the grain, put it in here and make gasohol out of it and put it in your tank and tell you that, you know, hey, that's a beautiful flow through the system. And like at least one professor at Iowa State says, no, not, you know, that's not efficient. And they all say, oh, no, you know, corn growers say, who is it on Sunday mornings on the TV show? Archer Daniels is a big deal, you know, I can't remember. They talk to you about gasohol all the time. It's clean for the environment, you know, it's true. But they don't quote the professor at Iowa State that tells you this is sort of an inefficient system. Now, we're not the only country that did that. In other words, we need energy for our cars. So where are you going to get this from?
Natural gas could be used.
That's right. So there's all these dynamics of the future that are going to change all these possibilities. Now let me just show you how alfalfa, this is the lucerne that I just showed you. There's one of the young men at the University of Minnesota where I'm an adjunct professor. He calculated out the total nitrogen that was fixed by alfalfa. And just to show you, if this is the soil, the line of soil, the surface of the earth, and if you harvest, you grow the alfalfa and you harvest all this off out of the total, and this gets fed to livestock, then part of it goes into the meat, part of it goes into milk, part of it goes the nitrogen in the manure, which goes back to the soil, and some of this nitrogen is lost. Okay? And it all has to do with growing alfalfa, the soil, what's happening to the nitrogen. Now, he's one scientist, and there are many. He knows precisely, this is the question, where is this lost? Is this that comes back to the soil, is that going to contribute to groundwater quality? Is that going to go on through the soil, or is it going to be retained in the soil in the upper layers that can be used by a subsequent crop. These are questions that, you see, the science can answer. In other words, nitrogen, this is a, if you look, if we looked at the nitrogen cycle for the railroad creek watershed here, we've got one nitrogen cycle. If we looked at it for Western Washington, we've got a nitrogen cycle we could describe. If you've got a farm, you got to describe it. So this is one that, that offers promise into the future. Also then, alfalfa can be used for some other alternative non-livestock uses. Look at these possibilities. Human foodstuffs, you've all had alfalfa sprouts. But you know, there's a limited market, I imagine, for alfalfa sprouts, but we all like those on ourselves. Protein supplements, biological material, pharmaceuticals, industrial enzymes, industrial commodities, chemical feedstocks, biomass energy resource, paper pulp. Now, biomass is a term that I'm sure you've all heard about. This is just the growing of vegetation. How much mass of biological material can we grow, and are we going to convert that to energy? Just like you used to chop wood out of the woods, cut wood out of the woods, burn it in your stove to give you energy, to give you heat. So that there's a tremendous amount of... So there are alternative uses to some of these crops that are beneficial. And he calculated through, this is interesting, if he took the state of Minnesota, took all of the energy that's used in the state of Minnesota, and here it's still mostly petroleum. So if he said 1960 versus 1990, and you see the use of petroleum for energy in Minnesota is half. Now, maybe President Clinton's BTU tax is going to, I don't know where it nails is on this. Maybe it's, I haven't had time to realize all the implications of this.
It got beat out.
Pardon?
It got beat out.
Did it?
Yeah.
Didn't make it.
It was in the paper the other day.
Oh, I see. Okay, natural gas made up a lot of coal and other. Okay, so that's, and that's a lot of energy. It shows that from 1960 to now, the state of Minnesota, I don't know what's happened to the population, maybe it's gone up, but. Okay, so he calculated out what is the size of the potential biomass energy market if you were going to replace the coal part of it in Minnesota? In other words, let's say you're going to try to see if we can take this part, the coal part, and we're going to try to replace that with plant material that will work into an ecosystem growing on the farm. Well, 324 billion trillion BTUs. Forages have an energy content of 14 million BTUs per ton. The average forage yield was 3 ton per acre. It would require 7.7 million acres to replace the energy from coal. Then you say, do we have that much acreage in Minnesota that we could be growing biomass to replace it? And my question, I don't know Minnesota quite as good as I know Iowa. We don't have that much. Unless, and I wish I had a picture to show where the cropping is done in Minnesota, but I can't remember the total acreage. I know Iowa has about 35 million acres total, and Minnesota must be in that ballpark because it's bigger. So let's say it's 40 million acres total in Minnesota. And you total up all the crop acreages in there, some reshifting and changing, you could maybe grow the type of biomass we're talking there, that much in Minnesota. So you could, it can be done. Now whether it will be done will depend upon economics. But that is the approach as you look to the future. And of course, roughly, I mean, a lot of northern Minnesota should be back in timber, forest. And then down here where they crop very heavily, there should be a blending of things. So it depends upon the soil types in that state, what you do. But this is the way, how much would be economically value if you could use the forage as the biomass energy? Well, coal currently sells for $20 a ton. Forage has 50% of the energy value of coal. The value of the forage for replacement of coal is $10 per ton. $10 per ton, in other words, that's what they're saying. Could you afford to grow biomass on your farm if you only got $10 a ton?
Could you transport it to where it needed to be used?
You couldn't. Good alfalfa hay would sell from $75 to $100 a ton. Good alfalfa hay fed to livestock in those dairy parlors is worth much more than that. So there's, it's, you see, so the economics of this stuff is going to drive it one way or the other, a lot of it. So the good ideas are there. The technology, the idea of doing this is there. It's just that the economics has a lot to it.
There's another intrusion there with coal. It doesn't make any difference the weather is, but with the forage it does.
Yeah.
You might have them.
Yeah, and the other thing about the biomass from the vegetation is that if we just picture these leaves that are hanging on the trees out here, let's say we were gonna store those for winter. Well, they're 95% water. They're 90 or 95% water. Just think of trying to dry out all those leaves. How are you gonna bundle them? How are you gonna put them together? It's so that these things are not simply done. Sin.
Coal is really the leaves that are already stored.
Yeah, that's right. And millions of years, right?
Yes.
Yep. Yes.
Did they ever check what the biomass was in cattails?
Yes. Yes, they did. They
up in that northern part of the state where we are, there's acres and acres of cattails.
Yeah, and I think the big hang-up with cattails, as far as biomass, one of the big hang-ups was it wasn't a total yield or dry. If you, when you work in this area, what they do is you have to express the yields you have in terms of dry matter. So cattails, you had to get them dried out and then figure out how much you had. And even then, you had a very high yield. But harvesting cattails, you know,
It would be
quite an engineering feat, wouldn't it, to be able to harvest cattails.
Well, didn't they harvest them for the vests?
They could go out there with a lot of those cattails, cattail areas, they could go out there with a track vehicle and
that's right.
Harvest them.
Well, this is interesting because as I was pointing out to you last night, I just listened to the tapes on Senator Gore's book, you know, Earth in the Balance, Ecology and the Human Spirit, and he talks about this strategic environmental initiative, which we need. He talks about that we've got to realize that this is very, very, very important. During World War II and these times, we have done things when we felt they were important enough. And so actually, I guess your question is, I mean, sure, if it becomes important enough, I imagine you can figure out how to harvest cattails to get biomass.
It's not economically feasible to harvest cattails and you take your tractor in there and then you destroy your wetlands so that there's not, the new crop is less, appreciably less, and then after 3 or 4 years you've got nothing, or you've got a big mud and there's no cattails growing in there anymore, and therefore you spend all that time and money on something that's not going to be.
Yeah, there would be tough decisions to make because any of these things that within a conventional farm that you have now, let's take a southern Minnesota farm. Okay, he knows you know what that acreage is. That particular farmer is already being alerted and told that what he can and cannot do, he or she cannot do on that farm. And it's going to get tougher. By 1995, that farmer, that we just say, has to have filed a plan of how he's going to farm all of his fields in what sequence, if he wants to get any government support whatsoever for any of his programs. Okay, so the they're tightening down the screws on the farmer. So it's becoming. Some of the young people say, "Wow, you know, I want a farm. I mean, gee, I've got to have a license to go out and spread herbicide. I've got to go to the night school to study this. I've got to report this. I've got to do that. They'll come out and check to see this, to check that. You know, I think I'll get a job driving a truck in town, or, you know, and something like that." And so it's going to be. I don't look that farm costs are going to go down at all. They're going to go up, and that brings you back then to the, if you're going to go out and harvest cattails, you'd have to, maybe all of this has to be worked out. Are you in the process of developing a cattail harvesting culture for biomass? You have to satisfy all these other things. Are you endangering any species? Are, you know, right down the line? Are you destroying a wetland? And the wet, this is a huge argument in Washington, yet the wetland controversy. These lands that were once wetlands, do they have to be returned to be wetlands? Or the farmer drained it and he can farm it now? He's going to be allowed to farm it for a number of years before he has to return it back to wetland? See, these are all huge questions to get involved with politics. It isn't just straight production of this and that.
Well, what makes you wonder back home is, why is it every spring those big swamps are all burned off? Every spring the sky is just gray from.
And then there are some areas in seed production areas of Oregon where they grow seed for different things, yeah, that they have banned. They have banned burning of fields.
Well, this is all swampland.
Yeah.
But it's
been done on purpose.
Yeah.
And if it's classified, any of it as native prairies, they maybe are burning it, because that's the Department of Natural Resources is
8 to 10 inches of water on it.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll talk some more about that later.
Yeah.
They're trying to exploit oil exploitation in Antarctica, or the Arctic Ocean up there in Alaska and Canada, and that's why they're burning all those swamps, is to discourage people from understanding the environment around them, or whatever. I don't know. I just heard about it, something like that.
Well, these changes and anything is done in that regard. We're going to have to wrap it up here, because these were just some I put in because it brings in the matter of energy. Well, I guess what I want to wrap it up in a few minutes here is to, and then we can have some questions, is to just give some viewpoints about what we've kind of tried to do this week. Well, first of all, I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot by reading and digging into trying to present. I learned a lot about pre-agricultural times, hunting and gathering, just by getting into the books and putting that together for the first one. That's very fascinating. Then we had agriculture being developed from about 10,000 BC. On through, and just touched on some of the mistakes in agriculture that have been made, and the progress, and then the later years of the booming out of agriculture, and then last night we talked about the world food, you know, as how do we enter into that? Whose responsibilities are they to try to solve world food? And then today what I've tried to do is get back to saying, well, kind of where we're at. These questions are raised, and alternative agriculture is maybe not the answer, but here's a big report that's National Academy of Science, National Research Council. Hi, this is good stuff. Alternative agriculture, just about 2 years old. Well, here's a counter one, you know. They came out to use the same cover, and they said, well, this report isn't absolutely the gospel truth, so here's some stuff that you ought to look at. Now, are the Congress people, the people that vote on farm legislation, environment, are they going to read these? You got to digest it down. You have to put it into smaller packages, and maybe the congressional aide will find time to read this one on water quality and what agriculture viewpoint is. So there is a job to be done, I think, that needs doing, and that is awareness. And that's what I hope that you will realize, that some of the things I have said in these four sessions, that they may be, some of them be my opinions. I usually like to preface when I say it's my opinion. If it's a fact, then or we think it's a pretty substantial fact, we'll try to say so. But sometimes our opinions get in there. And so I hope that if you think I've said something that's kind of far out, that we can talk about it. But agriculture is dynamic. It is changing. I think it's very necessary. And because we all need food. And that's a basic need for all of us. Yes? So I think we'll close the tape on that because I'm sure we're up, but I'll take any questions.
Well, I was just going to mention that book I was reading on agriculture called Gaining Ground. I think the title of it, I'm not sure of the author's name, but the title of it really suggests that alternative agriculture is possible, but it's a war every foot that alternative agriculture might gain away from agribusiness.
Good.
You don't have to get rid of animals or do all
right.
these modern things necessarily.
I hadn't heard about that one. I hope we can find that one. I'll like to talk to you afterwards because there was a book by Eric Eckholm called Losing Ground about 15 years ago. Losing Ground, and that had to do with soil erosion and desertification around the world. That was a good book. And so I hadn't heard about this one, Gaining Ground. That'd be very interesting. Yes?
One of the things that I see as hopeful is the renewed interest in gardening and home gardens. I think a lot of children today haven't had the opportunity to grow up in a farming community, so they've gotten so far away from the food production, even seeing what happens in food production. And teachers aren't able to educate that much in schools unless kids have a firsthand knowledge of how what it takes to grow food. I think they really appreciate the box of cornflakes and you know, what goes into food production.
Do you know of any programs where this is where they're sponsoring this?
Kellogg has funded a program in Arizona to
is
teach
right?
children gardening mm-hmm. in their schoolyards.
Very good. I think that's positive because if you go back along with what Senator Gore in to get at this job that needs to be done. That would really fit. In other words, if you could have victory gardens during World War II because we were short of this and that, we could have environmental gardens or ecology gardens for young folks. And so I wouldn't be surprised if that type of a movement will be coming. In the meantime, I was going to calculate out, maybe I will for either next week, I'm going to be here teaching some more, I was going to calculate out how many gallons of gasoline were saved by Carol and I being out here 3 weeks rather than back in Minneapolis driving our cars and tending to everything we had to do. And I didn't quite get it calculated, but it is of interest to me. I about got it worked out in my head. I need to just take a piece of paper and do it is how many gallons of water moved down a 9 mile or 10 mile creek down the road? How many gallons of water go through that from if you go look at that river this morning before breakfast and you go back tomorrow morning, how many gallons of water go by? And you calculate it out. And that's just constant. It looks the same this year as when we saw it last year. It's just constant. The water cycle, you know, just and that water going down Railroad Creek into Lake Chelan and somehow or another diffusing out over and down into the Columbia River, down the Columbia River. Up into the irrigation system, producing the apple which we eat up on the table. You know, it's a fantastic story. It requires a lot of input by a lot of people, a lot of understanding, awareness, and so I hope that just thinking about where our food comes and consideration of it has been helpful.
Yeah,